Harding College has developed an oral history library for the purpose of recording the life and experience and the voice of great men who have meant so much to Harding and to America. We're honored this afternoon in inducting Dr. George S. Benson into Harding's Oral History Library. Dr. Benson is president of the National Education Program, president emeritus of Harding College, chancellor emeritus of Oklahoma Christian College, elder of the College Church of Christ in Searcy, Arkansas, former missionary to the Far East, and many, many other activities in which he has been involved. Dr. Benson has made a tremendous imprint on Christian education, missionary endeavors, citizenship education, and the work of the Lord. His is a life of great service, hard work, and dedication to truth and righteousness. He has blessed multitudes of people and has given us a great example to follow. There is so very much that we can learn from his life, his experience, and his philosophy, and it's certainly a privilege to interview him and to record his life and his voice for posterity. And I think, Dr. Benson, it'd be good for us just to begin with the beginning, to the day that you were born and the location and the place and some of your early experiences in life that you recall.
Well, thanks. I was really born in what was probably the United States' last western frontier. As directed by the editor of the New York Times, men moved west in the United States. But they moved around Oklahoma Territory because that was the home of the American Indians who had been brought there from many parts of the United States. Finally, the government decided to ask the Indians to take a quarter section each and then open the rest of the Oklahoma Territory to settlement by other peoples. My father went into the land that was originally a grant to the Cheyennes and Arapahoes and took land there about 1895. That was then called Oklahoma Territory. And later, that particular spot became known as Dewey County, Oklahoma. I was born in a two-room log house, September 26, 1898. Was the second in a family of five children. One sister older than myself, then two brothers and a sister younger. My parents were hardy, both of good health. They were both devout Christians. Preachers in that area of Oklahoma in my early days, however, were pretty scarce. You didn't see them often. But the frontier settlers would meet in a schoolhouse for church services Sunday morning, Sunday night. They would conduct their own Bible study. Maybe a preacher would come along once in several months and occasionally to stay a few weeks. The first schoolhouse was built of logs, and the first meetings I remember in it were these meetings of people for Sunday school and Bible study. And then, of course, used also for school purposes. The school terms in those early days were short, probably 4 months, 5 months at the most, 6 months in the country schools. As towns grew up, the term of school became longer there, running 7, 8, and occasionally 9 months. During those early days, our closest railroad was 50 miles away. So really, it was a frontier. A neighbor's wife, 3 miles from our home, conducted a small store with a few staples. Consequently, the people relied very much on their own ability to provide their needs. They, everyone, of course, farmed. Then they raised hogs and cattle. They had plenty of meat. There was also wild game, deer, turkey, prairie chicken, quail, and rabbits. So people had wild meat, or they provided it from their own herds. Then they provided grain, of course, from their fields and ground it with an ordinary grain grinder to make their corn meal and to make their wheat flour. Then as soon as they could grow fruit trees, why, they grew fruit trees and then grew and canned a fruit. In the neighborhoods, the neighbors also were very neighborly. They helped one another. Farmers would help raise a new house as logs had been prepared. They would help get in a man's crop if he had sickness in the family, or if he were flooded out. I remember one time a man living on the South Canadian River was flooded out. He had lots of pumpkins and corn in his field, and here the water was coming up higher and higher, and finally it was knee-deep over his fields. So the neighbors came in and helped carry out his pumpkins and helped carry out his corn. Then the water did come on higher, and he wouldn't have seen that field for 6 weeks, and his pumpkins would all have been washed away. But neighbors never charged for things like that. I remember he put a couple of pumpkins in my father's wagon for going in and spending a day or two helping him clear out his fields. But men didn't have money, so he didn't expect money. There was very little occasion to have money. I asked my father later how much money he thought he handled per year in those early days in western Oklahoma. He said maybe $50. Mm. Well, I suspect it was more than that, but yes. You got money by hauling corn or castor beans or fat hogs 50 miles to the railroad. And you couldn't do that alone. Two or three neighbors had to go together. They had to what we call double team to get across the streams and across some of the canyons where the one team couldn't have pulled a wagon, but two teams would be put on it, maybe three, and then they'd go back and get the next man's wagon, then back and get the next man's wagon. So to make that 50 miles to market and get home again took all week. If you left Monday morning, got back Saturday evening, you'd had good luck. Consequently, they didn't go to market very often, and consequently didn't have very much money. But they would exchange pork for beef, pumpkins for cucumbers, and raise their own fruit and grains, so they didn't have to have very much money. And the wives in those days made the clothing for the children. They didn't buy it. They made the work shirts for the men. So, naturally, they did handle very little money. There were no doctors near. Families relied almost entirely on home remedies. A few people in the community generally reputed as being pretty good on home remedies. If there was any serious illness, they were called and would come. But there was no doctor very close to be called. But people, nevertheless, were so neighborly that morale was high. I never heard people complaining. Nobody went hungry. Nobody felt poor. Nobody complained. I suspect no people in America have been happier than those frontier people were. They took a good deal of pride in the fact they were able to solve their own problems, do their own blacksmithing, mend their own harness, repair their own wagons, plow their own fields, plant and harvest their own crops. Of course, as time passed, railroads came closer. After a few years, towns began to grow up. Doctors began to move in. Roads began to be improved. Markets began to expand. Conditions changed quite rapidly, and prosperity came. Now, of course, that region is one of the great states of the Union. Much oil has been found in Oklahoma. There's a great deal of wealth in Oklahoma.
Dr. Benson, in all of this frontier experience, how did a young farmer boy fit into the picture? What were some of your duties and responsibilities?
Well, children, of course, began work very young. You see a scar on my front lip. I got that one day when I was following my father as he was breaking new ground, and I was dropping corn in every third furrow. He had a hired man that was grubbing out trees. He had dug a hole beside a tree, and he was standing down that hole trying to get to the taproot of that tree. My father was going past with a plow. This man stepped out of the hole and let my father pass with the plow. I happened to be coming right behind him, looking down at the ground, dropping corn. He stepped back in that hole and swung back over his shoulder a double-bladed axe that caught me there on that lip. But there was no doctor to take stitches those days. My father's remedy for a cut like that was turpentine and sorghum molasses mixed.
Sweet and bitter at the same time, I guess.
That's right.
What about your educational experience, Dr. Benson, in these early days? You mentioned the schoolhouse being a long way off. How'd you get to and from school, and how much schooling were you able to get nearby?
That's, of course, a problem that confronted the frontier people very seriously. Education was rather hard to come by. We had one-room school buildings, and in that one building was accommodated all of the grammar school grades, 1 through 8. There would be one teacher. And oftentimes the teacher had students in all 8 grades, and yet one teacher handling all 8 grades and all the courses in each of those 8 grades. Naturally, recitation periods were very short, 3 to 5 minutes oftentimes was all. so students had to pretty much do their own work on their own. I attended a grammar school 3 miles from home. Part of the time I walked it. Later, when Father had more horses, we were able to ride or drive. But I thought I was doing pretty well when I got so I could run that 3 miles in 30 minutes.
Oh.
And be home doing chores when I'd hear the first bell ring, which was 30 minutes.
Yes.
That was a warning bell. And then run in and change my overalls that I did chores in to the newer overalls that I wore to school. And then run that 3 miles for the time that second bell would ring. And I had no teacher all the while in grammar school that had had more than a grammar school education. They could take teacher's education after graduating from 8th grade, and if they passed, they could teach. And I had no other kind of teachers. And I didn't have a teacher in 7th and 8th grade who could work the more difficult problems in arithmetic. Mm-hmm. So I had to figure them out at home. I've worked sometime for a week on one. I remember one particularly difficult one for youngsters in 8th grade. And it said a man took a 1 cubic foot of copper, stretched it into a round wire, a 1/16 of an inch in diameter. How long was the wire?
Hmm.
Well, that'd be simple with algebra, but we had a time with that one. But we finally managed to get it. But that served me pretty well, because when later I took a county teacher's examination, in the same room and the same examination with teachers that had been teaching for 10 or 15 years, I made the highest grade in mathematics was made in the county.
Self-made mathematician.
That's right.
Were you already thinking about the possibility of working in the field of education at this time, an early age?
No. I started high school 12 miles from my home after I'd finished grammar school and worked 3 miles from the high school, so I'd feel at home traveling 3 miles to get to school. And then would walk home that 12 miles on weekends.
Hmm.
Then the second year I went to high school over in Claremore, Oklahoma. I lived a little closer to the high school. Paid my school expenses, including board and room, on a $16 a month janitor job. Then third year was done at Kingfisher, Oklahoma, where I worked on a farm 2 miles from town and went to high school. Completed high school in 3 years. But they allowed us to carry heavier loads in those days, so I made 19 units in those 3 years, 15 units in A's.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Benson, when you think back now, and of course it's been many years since you were a little boy, what were some of the parental philosophies and principles that you gathered from your mother and dad? If you were thinking now of what has really been basic in your life, what do you recall?
Well, I remember distinct honesty and a determination to accept help from nobody. Make it on your own.
The frontier experience.
That's right.
And yet your life has been one of service unto others and dedication to others all the way through. I guess this, too, is a part of the frontier experience. Going so far as you can on your own and then having help from others whenever you can't go on your own.
That's right. That's right.
Good. You mentioned church a moment ago. The churches were few and far between, and preachers seldom came in the community. What kind of experience did you have religiously, other than the occasional visit of the minister?
We would have meetings Sunday morning, Sunday night, in which there would simply be mutual exhortation. Passages of Bible would be studied, and perhaps several people would make talks. Then also a meeting on Wednesday night. I can never remember when my parents didn't attend those meetings. I became a Christian at 15 years of age and soon was teaching Sunday school on Sunday mornings and active in young people's work. Then I was able to go to college at Harper, Kansas, a junior Christian college for 2 years. I made my way to go there by farming to wheat. I could put in wheat in the early fall and leave it for the year and come back in the summer for harvest and replanting. Then attended Oklahoma A&M 1 year and took a B.S. degree there at the end of 3 years of college work.
What was your field of study there, Dr. Benson, in Oklahoma?
History.
In history?
Yes, mm-hmm. Major in history.
And from there, where did you go?
The next fall, after graduating from Oklahoma A&M, I began teaching in Harding College, which now had been taken over in reality by Arkansas Christian College, and the name had been changed to Harding College. And I came in there in the fall of 24 as principal of the academy and remained through the year of 24-25. I had already decided while in high school that I wanted to be a missionary. Then each year while in college, I had tried to study mission fields to try to determine which one that I would finally enter.
What areas or what fields did you consider at this particular time when you were still in college?
I soon simmered it down to two, and that was China and Africa, the two that I thought were most needy. Finally decided on China because it had about one-fourth of all the people of the world, and at that time we didn't have a single Church Christ missionary in China. We did have a few in Africa.
When you decided to go to China, what steps did you take, and how did you go about seeking support or assistance, and how did you finally make your way over to the Far East?
That was a problem, because at that time there was among the Churches of Christ very little missionary zeal. There wasn't a single one of our colleges giving a single course on missions, and you rarely heard a preacher preach on missions. When I began talking of going to China, nearly everybody wanted to dissuade me. Very few gave encouragement. When I began seeking support, that was very hard to come by, and contributions were very small. But finally, I got together enough money to go and had a promise of $45 a month personal support. That increased after I left. I never had to live on that little, but that's all it was promised at the time I went to China in 1925.
And you were married at this time?
Yes. I married in July of 1925 and sailed for China in August of 1925, six weeks later.
Sort of a honeymoon then in
the
Far East.
That's correct, that's correct.
Slow boat to China, I presume.
It was. Took 30 days to get to Hong Kong from San Francisco.
I see. And you went to Hong Kong, and then from there, where did you go? What is a tracing of your steps then in the Far East for a while?
Well, stayed in Hong Kong about 6 weeks, then started interior. And went way up into Guangxi province, about 500 miles interior. There were three other Americans in that town, no others within probably 200 miles. My wife and I studied language there about 6 hours a day during that entire winter and spring. We made a good deal of progress in language. But Communists were moving in at that time and began agitating against all foreigners. And in the spring and summer of 1926, all missionaries in China were driven out. I have a missionary directory that was prepared at that time in Shanghai. It has the names of 6,000 missionaries who were in China at that time. My wife and I were the only ones from our Churches of Christ, but missionaries were there from all parts of the United States, from various European countries, from Australia, and other places. But all 6,000 missionaries were driven out by the communists in 1926. That was my first experience with the communists. And one of the things I observed was how deceitful they were and how lucky they were with it. For instance, the communists wanted to take over China. Well, here were 6,000 missionaries that would not naturally be friendly to an atheistic movement like communism. So the communists decided to get rid of the missionaries. They persuaded the Chinese themselves to drive out the missionaries, and the Chinese did not know why they were doing it. And they were driving out their very best friends. Among those missionaries were experienced teachers, doctors, nurses. And China had need for every doctor, every nurse. The death rate among their children at that time was 80%. Yet they rose up and drove them out because the communists had convinced them these people were their enemies. And they did that by appearing to be in great sympathy with the poverty of China. Then they assured the Chinese that their poverty was entirely because of the exploitation of the capitalist nations. Next, they persuaded them that the spies of these capitalist nations were the missionaries. and that they had reason to know that every single missionary was on the payroll of his government and there is a spy. Their next point was that the poverty of China would continue just as long as these spies were permitted to stay, and that it was the duty of the people to rise up and drive out the spies. So then the Chinese began to get excited and began to build up hatreds, and pretty soon they were viciously attacking all the missionaries and really driving them out. And we had a good deal of difficulty getting out because they had boycotted us till we couldn't travel by boat and there was no other means of travel. We were 6 weeks getting a boat that would carry us downriver after it had gotten thoroughly dangerous to even stay there in Guangxi. Finally, a boat captain came along who had been in America, and he agreed to take us on his boat. And the pickets shouted that they would burn his boat. He didn't dare take any foreigners, but he insisted he would. Said he'd been an American, the people treated him like a brother, and he was going to treat these people the same way. So he did carry us down the river, and with a good deal of difficulty in Wuchao and again in Canton, we finally got out of communist territory. But I paid $75 to be moved the last 100 yards out of communist territory.
Pretty expensive move.
That's right.
Worse than our New York taxes. When you were forced to leave China, Dr. Benson, this particular time, did you move over to another area in the Far East to continue your mission activities?
Oh, that's a good point. No, I stayed in Hong Kong most of the time for 2 years and did work in Hong Kong. The last summer and fall, the last half year, I worked in the Philippine Islands in Mindoro. About half the missionaries who were driven out of China in 26 never did go back. About half stayed in the Philippines or in Hong Kong or Cheongjiao or other foreign place they could take refuge, and then did go back after 2 or 3 years. And the communists were driven out of South China, East China, and North China. And we went back in February of 1928.
Now in Hong Kong, of course, you had a lot of English-speaking people near you. Were you continuing your studies in Chinese at this particular time?
Yes, we continued to study in Hong Kong all this time. Chinese is very difficult, and we continued to study it all the time.
It must be a difficult thing moving from a culture such as ours in the United States to a nation like China. What were some of the greatest difficulties that you personally experienced in making this change from one civilization to another?
Well, everything was different. You had a very different climate. It was hot, and the summers were very humid. The locks on your trunks would rust. Your shoes would mildew overnight. Water would gather on your walls and trickle down the walls and be mopped up from the floor during the spring of the year. And then the food was different. The associations were different. Everything was different. I think the American adapting to a country like China has quite a task, and I think it's a slow, difficult job. But we grew to like the Chinese people, and after the communists had been driven out, we came to have very substantial friends in China and were able to lead a great many people into the Church of the Lord.
When you first started your work in China, what were the principles and policies by which you tried to operate, that is, so far as missionary endeavors are concerned? How did you go about reaching people in this new and strange climate?
Well, that's, of course, the very key to all missionary work, and it isn't easy, certainly. But I had to learn by experience. We had no missionary training courses here among our own people at that time. So I went to the mission field without any knowledge of missionary methods, without any knowledge of the real problems that I would meet. So I floundered a great deal and made a great many mistakes. It took me 4 years to begin to get my bearings. Then I taught a year in Sun Yat-sen University, my fifth year there. That proved to be the most helpful of all the years that I spent in China. It brought me in contact with educated Chinese for the first time, with influential families for the first time. And these families provided counsel thereafter. We made also our most fruitful converts then. So Here are three things that I came to understand as being very essential in missionary endeavor. Number one, in a country like China, Africa, Japan, we must rely on the nationals themselves to do nearly all of the preaching. We're foreigners, we're suspected, they're suspicious of us. We never really very well understand the people. We can never be effective evangelists in their countries. And their suspicion of foreigners alone would keep us from ever being very successful evangelists in their countries. So the work must be done by the nationals. Number two, the nationals must have a lot of teaching. They are steeped in their heathen religions. They worship those gods through great fear. They're afraid to change. They're afraid to desert the old practices. Then in the second place, Christianity is totally new. They've not known the living God. They'd never known of a Bible. They knew nothing of Jesus Christ. So it takes time to build an understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and it takes time to develop enough faith that they're willing to desert the old religions that they've been a slave to for so many generations. So this long period of teaching is something we had to adjust ourselves to. You'll need 4, 5, or 6 years of consecutive teaching to build real Christian character. And that leads me to mention what I think is the golden text of missionary work. And that's 2 Timothy, 2 chapter, 2 verse. And Paul said, "The things thou wast received from me among many witnesses, the same commit thou unto faithful men, who shall be able to teach others also." Well, that's the secret of missionary achievement. If we can seek out faithful men and then teach them until they can teach others, and then they will teach others till they can teach others, and so on, till it can spread throughout their countries. So we began to realize that about the only way to get them for 4, 5, or 6 years is in a boarding school, and then bring in young people who want to study and teach them there in the boarding school for 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, or longer. And then you can have people that are well enough grounded, well enough informed, that they can teach others. They're also grounded so that they can withstand the tremendous pressures that they're bound to meet. For instance, in a heathen country, when a person becomes a Christian, his parents are not sympathetic with it. His relatives will not be sympathetic. And in these heathen countries, children are not so independent as in America. They're much more bound to observe. They dictate to their parents. And if one is called unfilial, that's about the worst thing can happen to him. So it takes quite a while to get enough grounding that they will not give way to those pressures and worship again the old spirits, the old idols, and the ancestors, and so on. So the school has proved to be an essential part of a missionary program in a heathen country. After they've been taught 4, 5, 6 years, then they'll go out and work among their own people and work effectively, able to defend themselves because they can read the Bible well, they can explain it, and they've developed faith in God. They're willing to endure all the fears of their ancestors and neighbors and still be Christians. So most of the churches that exist in heathen countries have been started by the natives themselves after they've been taught 4 or 5 or 6 or more years. The third essential point that we learned in missionary methods was the fact that it's a disadvantage to nationals in any heathen country to put them on American pay and expect them to do successful evangelistic work. Naturally, we had assumed that's the way to begin. As soon as we had people well enough taught, put them on American pay and let them go out and work full-time in evangelistic work. But we found in China that the people who were on American pay were not respected. And we should have understood that because the Chinese are a very proud people. They think China's the central country of all the world. Around it were grouped the barbarian nations. So they were prejudiced against all foreigners. Fact of the matter is, after being in 25 different countries, I haven't been in a country yet where the people didn't think they were superior. That means that they look down on foreigners, the way I was taught to do, to look down on foreigners. Now, when a man comes into a community, even though he be a national, and he tells the people that he's on American pay, and he'll have to tell them because they're going to ask and insist on knowing how he's supported, That's just part of the routine there, to inquire when a new man comes into the community, where he came from, what his business is, how he makes a living. And when he explains he's on the American salary, the people immediately think, well, a man is always controlled by the people who pay salary. This man gets a foreign salary. Therefore, he's controlled by foreigners. Therefore, he's here to promote some kind of foreign proposition. We're suspicious of foreigners. We're going to keep pretty close tab on him. We don't want him to get much of a toehold here. Well, now, that's the attitude in Africa. It's the attitude in China. It's the attitude in Africa. Quite contrary to what we naturally first expected. We would have thought a man would be considered fortunate to be on an American salary, but he's not. He's in China, the running dog of the foreigners. And so abused that many of them would just ask not to be on American pay, because it created a stigma that they didn't want to live under. This means that in your school, where you're training people to be preachers of the gospel, you need also to teach them a way to make a living. Because at the beginning, they do not have churches there that are going to pay them. You want them to go out to evangelize in new places. And they must be taught how to make a living. In China, we learned in the Canton Bible School to teach them English, history, math, in addition to Bible, and to teach them also the Chinese literature, so that they could go out and start a school on their own. There were no public schools in those days. Any man could start a school that wanted to, and if he could teach well enough to have students and charge them tuition, then he'd live from it. So we prepared our students at the Canton Bible School to be able to go out and start a school. And they could go almost anywhere in China and start a school. And if they could teach at all, they'd have students. They could charge enough to pay the rent on the room they had rented for the school and to take care of their own living. And then they could preach at night. And the fact they were school teachers made them looked up to. The fact they were making their own way gave them a recognition. And then they could preach the gospel and do it much more effectively. So that's the third point that we learned. In a heathen field, don't put your evangelists that you create there on American salaries. And I think that would be good counsel in any country.
You emphasize, Dr. Benson, the importance of education. Of course, this was a number of years ago when you were working in China. Do you think this is still true today, that the school system or the use of a school is very important in a mission field?
It is certainly in the heathen countries like China, Japan, and India, and Africa. I think it offers the only way of developing Christians who will be mature enough, developed enough, and enough grounding to be able to withstand all the pressures that are put upon them and to advance the cause of Christ. So yes, I think the schools are just as essential as ever.
You emphasized a moment ago the fact that you went over untrained, so to speak, because you had no classes here in college. What were some of the most discouraging aspects of mission work? You know, a lot of them come home within a year or 2 years, sick at heart and sometimes sick in body. What did you experience in this area?
Well, you're right. Many of them lose their health because they will not be careful. I was fortunate in that regard in being able to attend a class under an English doctor who had been 30 years in China during the time I was driven out of China by the communists. He taught us how to preserve our health, how to be cautious about our food and our various living habits. And that was very beneficial to me. My wife and I neither spent any time in bed because of illness during those years in China. And that was true of very, very few missionaries. Then the second place, you have the difficulty, of course, of a very slow start. We were the first missionaries in China from our Churches of Christ. Our start had to be slow. And perhaps one of the things most discouraging was not understanding the people and yet thinking you did. For instance, when I started preaching, I thought when I'd explained the gospel to people, they could accept it. I didn't know then that when people were so steeped in their heathen religions that at first they would think they could be a Christian and still observe their old religions. And you'd tell them they'd have to give them up, but they thought you didn't really mean it. You just meant to cut down on them. So we were disappointed because people we thought we'd converted weren't converted at all. And when I began trying to preach to them, at the beginning, I didn't know how to preach to them. They couldn't have understood me anyway. So That was perhaps the most discouraging feature, your inability to be understood and your great ability to be misunderstood.
I know sometimes people use the method of loaves and fishes to try to get people in to help their physical needs in order to reach them spiritually. Did you have an experience with this particular type of thing? And if so, what was the result?
We didn't do it, but we did see lots of other people doing it. And our people have done it sometimes in some fields, but I think after it's been tried, it's recognized as a mistake. I think if they come for the loaves and fishes, you get a class of people that are insincere, because the ones of ability won't come for the loaves and fishes. The ones who do come for the loaves and fishes are the ones who lack stability and character. And if you get a group of those first, better people won't join them, and they have great difficulty ever being on their own, so you'll have something to take care of a long, long time if you start that way.
You mentioned a moment ago that you were able to reach a number of people, imparted people, when you were teaching at Sun Yat-sen University, and many, of course, were converted to Christ. Of course, we know that the communists have taken over China since the time that you were there. What has happened to these people? Is there still a vestige of the church there, and in view of the difficulties that they experience? What do you know about the results?
Communism in China has been very rough on the church. For instance, the communists, when they took over, gave the missionaries a choice of going home or going to jail. Naturally, they went home. Then they called on the Chinese preachers and said, "You completely stop all evangelistic work. No public preaching anymore." And the preachers who didn't respect that were shot and killed. The ones who lived were the ones who met only quietly in their own homes for worship. When I was back in Hong Kong in 1960, I was able to see people who had come recently out of China. I saw people who had been associated there with some of the finest Christians I ever knew. For instance, Leng Hoigeet was dean of the Canton Bible School. A very fine Christian gentleman and a very effective preacher. Well, he was still living in 1960 in Hong Kong, but the picture I saw of him showed him very much bloated and yet his face very thin. He'd lost weight, and the bloat indicated the starvation, the malnutrition. The Chinese have taken care that Christians didn't get good jobs, and they've had a very difficult time eking out a meager sort of a living, and they must do no propagating of the Christian religion.
Some of the people then that you knew ended up in prison or even in death.
Oh, yes. I talked to one preacher who said, "I saw 40 preachers shot one afternoon." Said, "I was in the group and marked to be shot. But darkness came on, they hadn't finished. So the rest of us were left over for the next morning." And he said, "That night I managed to escape. And then made my way through 100 miles of communist territory by hiding in bamboo thickets in daytime and sneaking along at night trying to avoid guards and avoid barking dogs."
And today it's just impossible, I guess, to get back into the mainland of China in order to work among the people there.
No missionary would be permitted into the mainland of China to do missionary work at all.
Dr. Benson, what of your family? You and your wife were newly married when you went to China. Any children born there?
Yes. Ruth was born there in November of 1926. Lois was born in February of 1928. And they grew up there, attended Chinese schools, spoke Chinese when they couldn't speak English, and still remember a good deal about China.
Does this mean that you and your wife spoke in Chinese to each other in
no,
home?
No, we didn't. We purposely spoke English at home because we wanted Ruth and Lois to know both languages.
Yes.
But they were with the Chinese so much more that they wouldn't even speak Chinese to us, although they understood what we would say in English, but they'd answer back in Chinese because it was their preferred language.
When you were in China, did you take much interest in political and economic and social conditions of the people? I know you spent most of your time in the spiritual realm, but were you interested in these other areas as well?
Yes, I was interested in trying to know why China was so poor. I had assumed before going that it was because perhaps all their resources were exhausted, but I found this was not right. They had oil, They had iron and coal, but these remained in the ground, and during the years I was there, none of them were being exploited at all. The people were importing all their coal, all their oil, and all their metal products. And farming was the only industry that was doing well. 90% of the people lived on the farms. The average farm was only 3 1/2 acres. Consequently, it had to be tended by hand tools. A man working a 3-acre farm can't earn enough money to afford tools. So, and then he'll eat practically all he produces. He has almost nothing to sell. So they continued to farm by hand. The only livestock used in their farming was a water carabao, and not all farmers even had a water carabao. All the rest of the work was done by hand, harvesting by hand, thrashing by hand, hulling of the rice by hand. And then he ate it with chopsticks. That was done by hand, too.
Did you have much opportunity to travel while you were over in the Far East to see different parts of the world?
Yes, I made 2 trips through China from the south to the north, and 2 trips through from the east to the west. So I had opportunity to pretty well see all parts of China. And then spent a little time in Japan, and a 1/2 year in the Philippine Islands, and a little time in India. So we really got to see most of the Orient, and how the people lived in nearly all parts of the Orient. And we found the poverty in India to be just as great as in China, where people were actually living on an average of less than $50 per capita per year. I mean, they lived by the year on what you could have bought in this country at that time with $50. Well, that meant eking out a very, very meager living. And the cause, in my opinion, after studying conditions there, was chiefly bad government. The people are very hard workers and have a great deal of ability. They can imitate anything they see others do. They would dispel the poverty of that country if they had good government under which they could work and would allow reasonable freedom of opportunity.
How long were you over in the Far East, Dr. Benson?
11 years.
Why did you return from your missionary work?
Well, that's a good question. Let me back up just a little bit. My wife and I came home from China on furlough in 1930. Then I entered that fall the University of Chicago, received a master's degree in history of the Far East. This helped me very much in understanding the Chinese people, because I learned that what I had been seeing and thought to be personal traits were actually national characteristics. I was able to go back understanding China very, very much better. Then I taught during the winter quarter after graduating from the University of Chicago with a master's degree at Harding College in missionary methods. Taught a course on missions, one on comparative religions, and one as an introduction to the history and languages and customs and manners of China. Then in the summer of 1932, returned to China. Started fundraising for the Canton Bible School building, and we built that building in 1934. It was finished. We moved into it. That was an enlargement of the Canton Bible School operation, which we had started in 1930. But problems and difficulties, language, customs and manners, religions, history of China, all these were problems we, of course, were working with. And in the meantime, we then were joined by 10 other people. Brother and Sister Roy Whitfield, Brother and Sister Lowell Davis, Miss Bernard, and Brother and Sister Oldham, and Brother and Sister Emmett Broaddus. So by 1936, we had about 56 students in the Canton Bible School. We had a number of churches going. Our students were beginning to graduate and go out and enter teaching jobs and start establishing churches. We were at a point that we felt like we could have in another generation a great deal of evangelistic work achieved in South China. Then in 1936 came a letter from G.N. Armstrong saying that I had been elected by the board to become the next president of Harding College. At first, naturally, I thought I wouldn't do it. My life was dedicated to China. I had no intention of leaving. But the other missionaries with whom we were then associated thought I should give it more study and consideration. Then I began thinking of the fact that nearly all new missionaries were coming out just as I went out, with no understanding of the realities of the problems on the field, almost totally unprepared. So I decided maybe I could do more for China from Harding College than I could from Canton, China, because our group would go on with our program there, and maybe I could inspire another group of missionaries to enter central China and another group north China. Consequently, I finally decided I would do that and then teach some courses in missions at Harding College and offer to lecture on missions in some of our other Christian colleges in an attempt to give our young people a better chance to intelligently judge their own suitability before going to a mission field. So with this in mind, I finally arrived at the conclusion I'd accept the offer. So I accepted it, and then in July, we left China, July 1926. Came home by way of Palestine and Europe, had a little time to observe all the way around on that route, and particularly some time in Europe. Then arrived in the United States in August, began my duties as President of Harding College on September 1, 1936.
Dr. Benson, your children were still quite young then, weren't they, when you came to the United States?
Yes, that's right. Lois was 7, Ruth was 9.
What were their impressions when they got to America?
Ah, that's a good question. They had seen the best in the Orient, they'd seen the best in Europe, but when they got to America, it was a brand new world. Their eyes were just booging. After a half day in New York City, Lois took me by the hand, looked up at me soberly and said, "Daddy, there's just one thing. I just hope heaven will be this nice."
Well, I'm sure it will, and far more. Harding College then became a very important part of your life, and you became a very important part of Harding College. 1936, September 1, that was the beginning of 29 years as president of Harding College. And a life of service, not only to China, as you continued to work in the interest of China and other mission areas, but also in Christian education in general, and Harding College in particular. And Dr. Benson, I believe Harding had just moved about 2 years earlier to the Searcy campus. It had been in Marlton, I believe, when you were in school, and then in 1934, in the summer, moved to Searcy and took over the plant of Galloway Female College, a Methodist school that had quit operating about 2 years previously, I think. And thus Harding College was in operation when you arrived to become president September of 1936. Would you mind giving us a little description of the plant here in the college and its operation, something of the size of it at this time?
Yes. The college itself at that time had 250 students. The high school, according to the yearbook for that year, had 48. And the grammar school 31, making a total of about 329 students according to the yearbook. Some students, of course, had dropped out, so actually the registrar's office gives the total enrollment for that year at about 374. And that, of course, included dropouts and the new enrollees that came in second semester and so on. So the size, you could say, was about 250 college students. And the plant itself was in pretty bad shape. It was badly run down. The furnishings in most of the buildings were very, very badly deteriorated. The plant itself would probably have been estimated at a value of about $500,000. However, it was bought by Harding College for $75,000. $5,000 had been paid down when the deal was made in 1934. The remainder was still to be paid after I came in 1936, plus interest. So the obligation was approximately $75,000 and a deteriorated plant. But we had one great advantage, as I saw it, and that was the high morale. The morale of the school on campus was excellent. And the real asset was the college staff. G.N. Armstrong as president, Dr. L.C. Sears as dean, B.F. Rhodes, professor of history, S.A. Bell, professor of science. Those were the men that really were the backbone of the school, that gave it its character and created its atmosphere. That was a real asset.
Did you have much time to think about the philosophy of education before you came back to become president, or did you just sort of grow into it? Had you ever even thought about becoming a college president?
No, I hadn't thought about it, and I was about as unprepared for it as I was for missionary work when I went to China. But I soon recognized certain goals that I considered very important. First was to attain North Central accreditation. The college up to that point had never been accredited, and that hadn't been a serious question in earlier years. But it had reached a point it was a serious question, and if the school was to continue to serve, it must have accreditation. Well, that meant, of course, a good many things. Then number two was to pay off the debt and build a college plant that would be favorable to accreditation. And that was quite an undertaking. Then number three, to increase salaries and build a strong faculty. And four, to continue to keep a dedicated faculty and a deep spiritual atmosphere for the building of genuine Christian character. I was thoroughly convinced that a Christian college had only one reason for existing, and that was to preserve a Christian atmosphere in which young people could get a Christian education.
How long, Dr. Benson, did it take you to pay off that debt? You had a mortgage hanging over your head, I guess, when you first walked on the campus.
I set a period of 4 years for paying off the debt and succeeded in getting it done in 3.5.
Well, good. In fact, I remember the day when it happened.
I bet you do.
This was Thanksgiving Day of 1939. I was a green freshman from New Orleans, Louisiana. And I can recall so very well standing out on the front of the campus and seeing the mortgage burn. It was quite a day for Harding College. What were some of your problems as an administrator now that you switched from mission work to Christian college education with all of the responsibility of administering a college and directing an academic program and assimilating a staff and working with them and the problems of administration plus fundraising, which is always a big one?
Well, those were major problems. As far as administration is concerned, in a small college like Harding was at that time and during most of my administration, when all departments are small and when the whole institution is somewhat like one big family, I think there can only be centralized administration. Your departments aren't big enough for anything otherwise. Consequently, I considered it my responsibility to know what was going on throughout the entire institution. On the other hand, I strongly encouraged a sense of responsibility on the part of every individual for the handling of his own assignment. And I think the system worked pretty well because I was able to be away a great deal in searching for funds for the college. Really, I was away at least 50% of the time, and some years when we had a strenuous campaign on, I was away 75% of the time, and still things rolled on smoothly. Every person carried his own responsibility, ran his own part of the show, and did a good job.
Administration and the college is certainly no easy task, and being on 50 to 75% of the time makes it even more strenuous. You had to spend a lot of sleepless hours at night, didn't you, in order to get this done?
Well, it was my practice, quite consistently, to work in the office every night I was home until 11 or 11:30. And during those night hours, nobody bothered me, and that's when I had to do nearly all the office work. Daytime, it was conferences and consultations.
Well, I've seen your light burning many an hour at nighttime as you were carrying out this, both as a student and then later as a teacher under your direction. What about the growth of the college through the years, Dr. Benson? When you came back, you said about 250 students. What were the periods of growth at this particular time, and in what way did the college grow? Was it a rapid growth or a slow growth?
I'd call it a slow growth, Dr. Gaines. Actually, if you take the average for the whole 29 years, the average is about 35 students per year growth, which seems very slow. But when you take 35 students a year for 29 years, you're adding 1,000 students. Well, that lifted the enrollment from 250 up to 1,250. That's a five-fold increase. So that looked like a big increase. But the increase per year was small. Now, there were years when we didn't increase at all. There were a few years when we moved back a little. And then during the latter years, we were growing at a rate of about 100 a year.
You mentioned that when you took over the campus, it was run down and certainly needed a lot of repairing and new furniture and equipment. How long was it before you were able to begin to move in this direction of helping to improve the campus? Or was it kind of slow at first?
It was slow at first, especially the first couple of years were slow, and then came World War II that made fundraising a bit difficult, so actually for 10 years it was slow. And that maybe was a good thing because it gave opportunity to put more emphasis on the spiritual. And I think a Christian college must recognize spiritual emphasis as its number one responsibility. That's why church-related colleges exist. There are plenty of state colleges for purely academic work. The Christian college has the responsibility of preserving our Christian culture, developing Christian leadership, not only in the form of preachers, but also elders and deacons and Sunday school teachers. And if a superior spiritual atmosphere is not preserved on a Christian college campus, then the real purpose for its existence virtually disappears. I know some of our older Christian schools thought that this could be taken care of by maintaining a strong department of Bible and religion, with little or no regard for the spiritual atmosphere in the rest of the institution. But Harvard, Yale, University of Chicago, and others are clear proof of the fact that that policy is a failure. Those institutions today do not have on their campus a strong Christian atmosphere. The fact they have a Bible department little touches the rest of the institution. I think in a Christian college like our own, every department in the college should make its conscious contribution to the spiritual welfare of the institution. Dr. Guinness, the question of tenure came up during those years, especially when we began to seek for accreditation with North Central. The question of tenure was up. Well, that's a problem that I think is inimical to excellence. Tenure can only benefit those teachers that are poorest. A good teacher doesn't need tenure. No school wants to get rid of its good teachers. And if a good teacher should, for any reason, leave one institution, there's no trouble finding a place in another. So good people are never hindered for want of tenure. The ones who benefit from tenure are the poor teachers who might have difficulty getting another place and who might be asked to retire from their present position in order that a better prepared person might fill it. And that was a problem that we had to fight with North Central all the way through, and we were successful in avoiding the adoption of a regular system of tenure. And I think the fruits of tenure are very evident from the results of it anywhere. And also by the fact that it's always the teachers that push for it, not the administration and not the board of directors.
Right. Dr. Benson, I know it was a difficult task to finance an institution like this, especially a small, young school. How did you manage to do it?
Well, Dr. Guinness, that was a very difficult problem in 1936, particularly for two reasons. First, we were in the midst of that Great Depression that ran from 1930 to 1940. Most people living today probably don't remember anything about that depression, but it was a very serious one, worst America ever had. Nobody had money, and to raise money was very difficult. Then the attitude of our brethren toward our Christian colleges was spotted. There were those who were strong for Christian education, there were those who didn't care. It wasn't like it is today. So that made it still more difficult. Then we had another problem. There was quite a fight on in the church at that time over premillennialism. The Harding College administration refused to take sides in that fight. Accordingly, it was branded by the strong anti-premillennialists as soft and as sympathetic to the other side. This was done to try to make the college take sides, which it still refused to do. And as a result, the college became unpopular in many circles and was ostracized in certain noisy camps. So this still added to the difficulty of getting money from Christian people for Harding College. Harding College was accordingly marked for failure. Some people told me I was certain to administer its demise. And sometimes it looked like that's what would happen. Nevertheless, we kept hammering away, trying to raise money to pay off the debt and trying to improve our equipment a little bit. And the Depression, of course, created another factor, which incidentally and surprisingly worked much in our favor. And the Communists had worked hard in America with very limited success from 1919 to 1930. Norman Thomas and others built a socialist party, espousing many of the communist goals. Neither did very well in America until the beginning of the Depression in 1930. American employees were doing well. They were getting the highest wages anywhere in the world. They had the highest standard of living known to hourly employees anywhere at any time, so they weren't too ready to go along with the communists and the socialists. But when the Depression came, and unemployment mounted, and money became exceedingly scarce, then the communists began to make more progress. Norman Thomas began to make more progress and began to run for president of the United States. A lot of Americans in the field of education and religion began likewise to move toward socialist principles. Well, I had been in China when communism came. I saw the deceit with which it came, and then I'd made some study of it and was also thoroughly convinced it was a godless ideology, which a lot of people seem yet not to have come to realize. Consequently, I started speaking out against socialism and against communism on every occasion. We didn't have money to put in any expensive programs, so to speak was the only thing I was prepared to do. But I took occasion on every graduation speech, every other speech I had a chance to make, to try to build greater appreciation for our American freedoms, for our private enterprise economy, for constitutional government, and try to point up the fact that even in the Depression, we were still living better than any other people in the world. And I insisted that we should seek to improve our own American way of life rather than desert it for a system that had never done nearly so well anywhere else in the world. As a result of this, I began to get invitations to speak before civic clubs, and then industrial and business groups, in practically every major city in America. These groups included, for instance, the National Iron and Steel Institute, the National Bankers Association, the National Association of Real Estate Boards, International Kiwanis Convention, various other bankers associations, state associations and the like, and the National Association of Manufacturers, the National Industrial Council Board, and so on. Well, now from these contacts, I began to raise money in larger chunks. I was the first one, I guess, in America to really break through the barriers to get corporate gifts of any consequence for a private college. This led to a court suit in New Jersey, where a suit was brought against Standard Oil Company in New Jersey for making a contribution to a private college. And the court decided in favor of the corporation. Then other corporations waxed a little bolder and began to give. So pretty soon we were able to count among our supporters here such corporations as Standard Oil in New Jersey, Standard of Ohio, Standard of Indiana, Standard of California, General Electric, International Harvester, Swift & Company, Quaker Oats, U.S. Steel, Bethlehem Steel, Republic Steel, Armco Steel, Inland Steel, members of the DuPont Company, and so on. So really, the Depression in this regard served us well. So after all, it's an ill wind that doesn't blow somebody some good.
These people were supporting you then because they believed in what you were preaching and what you were practicing at Harding College.
That was exactly it. They believed that socialism and communism were bad. They realized that a lot of people didn't understand it, and they realized that from a college base we were probably able to be more effective in support of these great principles that have made America the foremost nation of the world than from any other base. So they decided we should have an adequate base from which to carry on this program. Consequently, they became quite interested in supporting us.
Dr. Benson, I believe you appeared also before a congressional committee and back in this time?
Yes. My first appearance was before the Ways and Means Committee. We had just entered World War II. We suddenly had a shortage of labor, yet we were limping along with NYA, CCC, and WPA, all of which had been created during the Depression days to make jobs for people who could not find jobs. Yet after we had a scarcity of labor, didn't need anybody hunting extra jobs, we still had these three organizations, each of which was committed to doing things that didn't need to be done. No one of them was permitted to do the jobs that otherwise needed to be done. They were to make new jobs, make job efforts, and yet we still had them. So I appeared before the Ways and Means Committee to urge that to be eliminated, because they were taking a lot of money, they were making no contribution to the war effort, and we didn't need any one of them to make jobs. So I urged it to be eliminated and that the money be used to help win the war. This brought a great deal of criticism from Aubrey Williams, who happened to be at that time head of NYA, and who undertook to criticize us publicly. Particularly, he got upset when a group of about 15 students here at Harding College wrote to Washington and said, please eliminate us from the rolls of the NYA. At that time, the NYA was sending checks directly to students. College didn't have anything to say whether it would be or would not be continued. But the students all wrote in and said, just cut off our checks and use the money to help win the war. We find we can get plenty of other jobs. Then came a blast from Aubrey Williams. President Roosevelt, however, was a wonderful politician. He knew Aubrey Williams had made a big mistake, so he made Aubrey Williams send a telegram apologizing to the students.
Yes. You also, at this particular time, I believe, began to broaden your efforts with regard to journalism, in addition to your speaking everywhere that you could be invited.
Yes, that's right. But let me say right here that it was this corporate money that actually enabled us to pay off that debt in 1939. We had one $25,000 gift from Wilmington, Delaware. We had a $10,000 gift from another source. And it was these particular gifts that actually made it possible for us to pay off that debt, without which we just couldn't have done it. Then we proceeded with corporate money to construct new buildings on the campus, one after another, till we spent around $12 million on the plant. And at the same time, through wills and bequests, we began to develop some endowments, and our endowments ran up to about $12 or $13 million by 1965. This was a bigger endowment than any other church-related college in Arkansas had, and more endowment than all of our other colleges supported by Church of Christ people had. So really, our contact with industry served us very well. Now then, you came to the
question
next
of
question.
Your publications, your newspaper column, and monthly letters and such like.
Yes.
How did this all get started?
Well, those things were added one by one, just as need developed. For instance, I hadn't thought of doing any of those things. I was just speaking on our American heritage and trying to create more appreciation for it. Unexpectedly, I was offered free time, half hour once a week on KARK in Little Rock and WMC in Memphis. I accepted both of them, provided they'd cut it to 15 minutes. I didn't think I could use a half hour. So we started with a 15-minute program on those two stations. Then platters began to be requested by other stations. People today maybe don't understand what a platter is, but it was those 16-inch plastic discs that were made. And they could be shipped in the mail. So these began to be requested, and I began using money I was paid for speaking to make these discs and send them out to other stations. Then other people began to help on it. So pretty soon we were sending these out to as many as 360 separate independent radio stations. This continued for a period of about 10 years. Then I finally just got tired of it, and TV was coming along, so I notified the stations I was going to discontinue the program known as Land of the Free. But soon after the TV program, or the radio program started, Jared Trevathan from Batesville came down to see me. He said, I've been listening to your radio program. We'd like to have material like that in a column to use in our weekly paper. I didn't think you'd probably take time to write a column for one paper, so I'm here representing six county newspapers in Arkansas, and we'd all like to have a column telling the same story that you're putting in these radio talks. So I started a newspaper column. It wasn't totally new because I'd published a Canton Christian while over in Canton. It was a monthly paper reporting on our mission work. So I took this column on. And it started in these six newspapers. Then other newspapers began to ask for it and continued until it was actually running in 3,000 newspapers, about one-third of all the weeklies in America. The column is still running, but doesn't run in nearly so many papers as it did for the first decade. But it's still running in hundreds of weekly newspapers in America. Then the film program had a rather an unusual beginning. I was speaking one night for a women's group up in Detroit. In that group was Mrs. Harley Earle, who was the wife of the manager of the Detroit branch of General Motors. And I mentioned the fact we had this column going, we had the radio programs going, and that I would like very much to do some films. That I thought the films were going to become an outstanding channel in American education. She happened a little later to be on a General Motors boat excursion. Was invited one time to sit with Alfred B. Sloan up on the front of the boat. She told him about my remarks in Detroit. Consequently, Sloan sent for me to come to New York. We discussed the matter. He told me he had a foundation for economic education, that he had tried a number of economic films, but none of them clicked. He said, I always liked them, but nobody else seemed to care for them. So he said if we thought we could develop a group of films, he would provide the money. And he said, I'd like you to work hard on the first one, try to find the right pattern. He said, that's the way I make automobiles. I work hard till I get a pattern, and when it clicks, I make a lot of them. So we got hold of John Sutherland in Hollywood to help us work out a good animated colored cartoon picture to tell the story of our American way of life. I used the format that I was using to speak to high school students, and it seemed to go over well. We built this film out of the material that had been used in speeches. Then we took it and showed it before college students, high school students, labor groups, women's clubs. We passed along with it a questionnaire, asking each one to answer the questionnaire. One question was, what's the general impression this film made on you? A boy out in Oklahoma answered, make mine freedom. We decided that should be the name of the film. We hadn't named it yet. Then another question was, do you think it's fair to labor, capital, and agriculture? Those were the three major groups in America in those days. That was back in the 40s, right after World War II. Mm-hmm. Now agriculture has only 6% of the American people, and it doesn't rate very strong in Congress anymore. But it did then. Up till that time, no legislation had been passed in Congress that agriculture really strongly opposed. So our questionnaire asked that question, as it fared to the three groups. Well, you know, more than 90% of all the people who answered that questionnaire said it was fair to all groups. That was a very high rating. We went back to Mr. Sloan with the results of the questionnaires. He said, all right, you found a pattern, go ahead with others. And then he called Mr. Skink of MGM and asked him to see the picture. Mr. Skink looked at it and immediately asked his legal department to make a contract for it for 2 years, during which time we would not show it free to schools, colleges, labor groups or chambers of commerce or civic clubs. It would be shown only in theaters. Well, that gave us a far bigger audience, so this film went into theatrical use. It was shown as a short in about 12,000 theaters in America. We followed it with the next picture, Going Places, and then Why Play Leapfrog. And the first four that we made were all accepted by Mr. Skink and all made the rounds in the theaters before 12 or 15,000 theaters. The people who viewed them were delighted with these shorts. They were comical, they were animated colored cartoons, but at the same time they were selling some aspect of our American way of life. Theater managers wrote letters saying that they got more favorable comment on them than on any shorts they ever showed. Well, we continue to have made 10 of these animated colored cartoon pictures at an average cost of about $60,000 each. So this meant $600,000 invested in this group of pictures by the Sloan Foundation, which had been developed for economic education and which was thus fulfilling its own mission.
Dr. Benson, some of those, I believe, are still being shown today, aren't they?
You're right. They're more than 20 years old.
Yes.
But an animated colored cartoon has the advantage of not being dated.
Mm-hmm.
You take live action, and when the length of women's skirts change, or they do with their hair, or they style to their dresses, you're outdated.
Yes.
But an animated colored cartoon is undated, so they're still being used.
And the basic principles are still just as true today as they were 20, 25 years ago.
The basic principles do not change. We have updated the figures a few times in some of them.
Yes. You also had a monthly letter that you started back in those days, too, didn't you? To thousands of people over the country?
Yes. There were people who would say, I'd like to help fight this battle to preserve our American heritage, but I don't have time to do research. Could you help me out with research? As a result, we started the monthly letter, sending it only to people who requested it. And the circulation has grown to 50,000.
Mm-hmm. I remember also back about 1949, the beginning of a new type of forum, which we call the Freedom Forum. Would you tell us a little something about the beginning of this particular activity?
Yes. Industry was pretty much at a loss to know how to proceed because the new labor laws that had been passed had made it very difficult for an industry to even talk to their employees. They were pretty much hobbled and they were muffled. Then came the Taft-Hartley Act, and that allowed industry to have a voice, and they could talk to their employees without being penalized for it. So now industry was saying, what's our message? What can we do? How can we create a better understanding with our own employees? How can we maintain labor peace? So we announced at Harding College in the fall of 1949 the first Freedom Forum. People came here from more than half the states of the Union and spent an entire week discussing the problems facing America and what could be done to preserve peace and harmony and to continue to move forward. The major industries of the nation were represented. Actually, attending these forums that immediately became annual affairs came people from practically all the major corporations of the nation. And those forums made a tremendous impact. Industries went back and started educational programs among their own employees and in their own communities. As a result of that first forum, we developed a flannel board presentation entitled, This is Our Problem. It really told the story of the entire forum that we have a problem, and that problem is to sell our own American people on our own American heritage and preserve our own American way of life. And that flannel board story developed as a result of the people from the Swift Company going back and preparing a flannel board presentation to report to their own president on the experiences of the forum. When he saw it, he wanted all the employees at Swift and Company to see it. Then other companies sent officials there to view it and then wanted it shown to their employees. As a result, we helped refine it and improve it, and then it was adopted by the National Chamber of Commerce as a project, by various state chambers of commerce as a project, by various industries as a special project, and it was actually and literally shown throughout the United States.
And Dr. Benson, all of this that we've been talking about, the personal appearances, newspaper column, the land of the free, the monthly letter, the production of films, this made up what you call the National Education Program, I believe, as a part of Harding College at its inception?
That's right. This started as a division of Harding College. It was our feeling that patriotism ought to be taught in the college. and we attempted to develop appreciation for our American heritage, and this program was developed as a division of Harding College. It was well supported by people who believed in it and who recognized its need. It continued as a division of Harding College until 1954, when it seemed advisable to put it under a separate corporation. And that allowed it some freedoms that maybe improved its activities. At any rate, this was done. It was put under a separate corporation with a separate charter, and is now chartered as the National Educational Program.
Now, this was an area of adult education, basically, and nationwide. It was not just a local campus activity.
That's right. These materials were being used across the nation. As soon as MGM had run a picture for 2 years in the theaters, then we immediately made it available to the high schools and colleges and by chambers of commerce, civic clubs and the like. So the pictures were going out. They were being sold, they were being rented. The flannel board presentation went out very rapidly as we made the flannel boards and the symbols and shipped them throughout America. And then the forums continued, not only to be held here, we held forums in California and in Texas and in Michigan and in other states.
Dr. Benson, you mentioned the films on, the economic cartoons. You've made lots of others, I believe, too. What generally has been the nature of the films that you have made?
The early ones were entirely on our American heritage. Then later we began developing films on communism and socialism. More lately we're probably putting more emphasis on socialism and communism. We've recently developed 3 films with Herb Philbrick narrating. First one, what is communism? Second, what's the relationship between communism and socialism? And third, what can I do about it? Then more recently we've done another entitled Revolution Underway, which shows Stokely Carmichael and Rap Brown calling for total revolution in America for the overthrow of the United States government. They appear with lip sync, making these declarations. This picture is meeting with a very wide reception. We've filled orders for an average of at least 6 prints a day for that one for more than 6 months.
Has that been one of your best films that you produced?
Yes, I suspect that's had the widest distribution of anything since the one in 1960.
Communism on the Map, I believe.
Communism on the Map.
Yes,
that's right.
And what was the nature of this one, Communism on the Map?
The map was a map of the whole world. It showed communism starting in Russia and then gradually spreading, and spreading on out through till it's controlling more than a third of the whole world. And until they have their conspirators in every nation of the world. This one was very popular, and we filled an average of 5 or 6 prints a day of that one for probably a year.
And these films were used on television stations, I believe, as well as
That's
civic
right.
clubs and churches, etc.
All of them have been used on radio stations and in schools by civic clubs. Some individuals have shown a film until they've literally worn it out and then purchased another.
Yes. What was the result of all of this, this various activity that you've been talking about, the publications of films, etc., so far as Harding's national stature is concerned?
Oh, I think they lifted Harding's national stature very much. And particularly was that true among people of industry that recognized the real threat of socialism and communism. Some educators, on the contrary, disliked the program very heartily. Probably I was pretty unwise in promoting it as I did, but, for instance, sometimes an educator would say to me, what's your purpose of the National Education Program? When I said it was to create a better understanding of our American heritage and greater loyalty to our American way of life, the answer would be, well, that's not academic. You should present socialism, communism, and private enterprise, tell good and bad about each, and leave individuals to make their own choice, not indicate that you considered any one of them to be better than the other. Well, I oppose that kind of educational philosophy, because I think educators ought to be trying to build principles and ideals and character into young people. And when I would ask, in a case like that, how long must I study these 3, communism, socialism, private enterprise like and decide which is the best and then present it as the best? And the answer from certain educators would be, whenever you do that, you're no longer academic. In my opinion, the communists have promoted very much that kind of educational philosophy in America, but they don't practice it themselves. They're very positively promoting communism, but they'd like for us to not be positive in promoting our own American way of life.
Dr. Benson, I've seen the expression, Harding College, the college that speaks to the nation. And I think we've been discussing these particular facets in which they literally spoke to the nation. I've also seen many of these gold medallions around from Freedom's Foundation. Hasn't Harding been honored perhaps as much or more than any other college in the nation?
Oh, yes. We've received more awards from Freedom Foundation than any other one source. I think I've received 9 personally, and the college has received them. You yourself, Dr. Gaines, have received several personally. Then programs in which you and I have both participated here and other places have also received these Freedom Foundation awards. So certainly we have the greatest accumulation of them to be found anywhere. I was just looking over mine a few days ago and trying to find some way to mount them, and I was rather surprised to find that for my own and those of the college is more than 20.
Is that right? Well, fine. I know in 1958, Harding College won the top award in the nation for a college campus program. And even beyond that, some other campuses that had studied our program and started one of their own won the award, so I sort of feel like we've been instrumental in winning more than one.
That's
but
right.
It was as a result of this work.
Well, we've helped win several over at Oklahoma Christian College, out at Lubbock Christian College.
And Pepperdine and other places
and
as well.
Pepperdine, too, that's right.
And we're glad, of course, that they follow the pattern and, in a sense, win the achievement, too.
Yes, I wish there were colleges doing that in every state of the Union.
Certainly be very helpful. Dr. Benson, in your office you have a wall board of plaques, sort of trophies given to you by a number of Christian colleges indicating your interest in Christian education in general, not only Harding College. Would you give us a little bit of the background of your service? I know that no one has rendered more than you have in the area of Christian education. Could you tell me a little something of your involvement with some of these other institutions?
Well, thanks. Yes. My philosophy has always been, and it's been yours, that our business was to promote Christian education, not just to promote Harding College. Consequently, we have been quite liberal with our time and efforts. I've spent a good many weeks helping Oklahoma Christian College, Lubbock Christian College, Alabama Christian College, Freed Hardeman College, George Pepperdine College, and each of them has a plaque on that board expressing appreciation for that kind of help. In the case of Oklahoma Christian College, I have made a study that led to their moving from Bartlesville to Oklahoma City. And then I helped them launch campaigns in Oklahoma City and over the state of Oklahoma, helping them, I think, to raise a few million dollars. And in Lubbock, I've tried to assist a little there in some financial campaigns, and the same in Alabama Christian, Michigan Christian, Freed Hardeman. And I believe that that should be the attitude of our people in Christian education, to help one another. We're neighbors, we're friends, we have the same objective. And we certainly don't even have enough Christian schools as it is now, and all of them are crowded. So I think it behooves us from every point of view to have a cooperative attitude toward other Christian colleges. So I'm proud of that plaque.
Dr. Benson, even while you were serving as president of Harding, you were in the administrative staff, too, of Oklahoma Christian, weren't you?
Yes, 8 years overlapped there when I served as chancellor of Oklahoma Christian while also president of Harding. Naturally, my work was chiefly here, but I could reach out and help them in things they needed it in, and without hurting me here.
I think at that time you probably spent about as many hours in the plane as you did on the ground in between the two institutions.
That's
and
right.
For the institutions.
That's right.
How many miles would you estimate that you've flown in behalf of Christian education in the 29 years that you were president and since then?
I think at least the equivalent of 3 round trips to the moon.
Well, you qualify as an astronaut then. That's fine. In addition to your interest in Christian education and your tremendous efforts there, you also have been quite interested in missionary work during this period, even while you were still president of Harding. In fact, you said you came back hoping you could do a great deal of good for China. Not only for China, but you've also been interested in Africa. Would you give us a little something of your experiences and your travels and what you have been able to accomplish in the mission endeavor?
Well, I not only started the first accredited courses in missionary training that I think have been given in any of our Christian colleges, but I also encouraged the same in other Christian colleges. And after we started giving more training for missionaries, we've had less missionaries leaving the field after the first couple of years as failures. So I think the training has been very worthwhile. Then I've helped raise money for work in foreign fields. I've helped raise money to get a number of missionaries to the field, and I've raised most of the money that's gone into the school program in Zambia.
And you're still continuing to work in this particular area?
That's right. We're building right now a plant costing $250,000 in Zambia. We've raised a little more than $200,000. We're trying to finish out that task right now, and the plant is already about 90% finished. Mm-hmm. We're starting a 5-year training program, beginning with the high school level, going up to about 1 year in college, and we have 3 years of that already in operation.
Were you able to travel back to mission fields in the last few years to...
Well, my last trip to the Orient was 1960, and I was able to visit mission fields in Japan, the Philippine Islands, and Hong Kong. Then more recently, I've made 2 trips to Europe and to Africa, mm-hmm. The last one being last January and February and March.
So you're continuing your mission activities even while you're here in the United States and serving in other capacities.
That's right.
Now, what about the work that you're able to do as an elder in the church? I know you've been an elder here at the college congregation for many, many years, in addition to your other activities.
Yes, I've served as one of the elders here for the last 30 years, and I've seen the church program develop very, very much during that period of time. I can remember when our total budget was $10,000 to college church. Now our total budget is, what, slightly more than 100,000?
104,000.
104,000 now. And our missionary program has always given me much encouragement. For instance, we're spending right now about $30,000 a year in missionary work in Iowa. We're spending probably more than $15,000 a year in Zambia. And we're helping in several other mission fields. And I think it's very encouraging to realize that more than half of the total budget of the College Church of Christ goes for work away from our own community.
I think that's due because of your leadership and others who really believe in mission activities and more than just keeping house at home, so far as the church is concerned. Now, you retired as president of Harding College back in 1965, I believe, at the...
That's right.
After 29 years of service.
That's right.
And since that time, what have you been mostly involved in? I know you've continued your service to Harding. You continue to serve on the Board of Trustees of Harding College. And what other areas of operation have you been involved in?
Well, of course, as you know, my retirement was voluntary. I helped revise the bylaws that called for retirement at 65, and it was my opinion then and still is that that was a wise thing to do. But retirement, in my opinion, should be sort of like a vacation. People usually on vacation aren't doing just nothing. They may be working harder than any time on the job. They may come back totally worn out, but it was a change. Mm-hmm. And that's really what a vacation is. So I think a retirement should be the same as long as the body has strength to work, to continue in other things. And I continued 2 years after retiring at Harding College as Chancellor of Oklahoma Christian College, then retired from that and returned to Searcy to live. What I've continued all the time, of course, with the National Education Program, which has 10 full-time employees. Then I was interested in that college in Zambia, and I'm continuing to work with that. And those various jobs make a pretty full schedule. Then I'd like in these next 2 or 3 years to be helpful in every possible way in the present campaign for Harding College. And I hope by serving as chairman of the committee to push the campaign among industrialists, and that we can again be effective in obtaining effective financial help from that source.
Dr. Benson, you continue to work during the week in the National Education Program, which is, of course, one of your primary responsibilities. But I notice you're gone about every weekend, too. What do you do on the weekends?
I go one Sunday a month out to Dewey County, Oklahoma, my old home county, where we're building a new church in the town of Sealing, which is the foremost town of that county. Then the other three Sundays, I'm spending out raising money for Zambia, because we've got pretty urgent needs. Another $50,000 or $60,000 has to be raised. So I'm out somewhere every Sunday morning and Sunday night in the interest of Zambia. And we're raising an average of about probably $3,000 to $5,000 each Sunday.
Fine. I want to come back to the National Education Program today. What is its status and its basic philosophy and objectives as you now continue as president of this organization, which is separate from Harding College, but of course here in Searcy, Arkansas?
Well, it's been my privilege to see how people live all around the world. And I'm thoroughly convinced that in the United States of America, we have a standard of living fully two times as high as in Western Europe, and fully four times as high as in Russia or any other communist country, probably 40 times as high as in the more backward countries like China, India, Africa, most of Africa. South Africa is doing well, and Rhodesia, that represents the highest standard of living to be found in all Africa. But apart from those things, here we are with a standard of living that no other people in the world approaches. Canada's fairly close to it, but with that exception, probably no other country has standard living more than half as high as our own. Well, I think it's chiefly because of the Christian religion through which we build character, constitutional government which allows us personal freedom, and a private enterprise economy which inspires great incentive because of private ownership of property and private ownership of the tools of production, private ownership of our farms, private ownership of our corporations that produce our machinery, our clothing, process our food and the like. So it's my conviction that we should by all means preserve these institutions in America. But socialism and communism continues to make inroads. Our people seem to stand at the crossroads, not knowing which way to go. The purpose of the National Education Program is to try to point up the value of these great American institutions, the merits of our own American heritage, and to try to help more people understand what our heritage really is and what should be done to preserve it.
Are you doing this in the area of adult education alone, or are you trying to go down into the college and high school level so far as this type of philosophy is concerned?
We're working in both levels. We're working, of course, at the adult level, our national program letter, our forums and the like, our freedom forums. On the other hand, we're now moving more and more into the high school level. I think high school students are beginning to see the issues involved, and I think it's the very best time to help them understand what our American heritage really is. You see, Dr. Gaines, in the 30s, in the Depression days, we quit promoting personal freedom, private enterprise, constitutional government. We went on the defensive. That gave an opportunity for the communists to go on the offensive, and they've really taken advantage of it. They've been sowing discord, trying to alienate our people from a private enterprise economy, even from constitutional government, and certainly from the Christian religion. Unless there's a real effort made to restore faith in these institutions, we're going to lose them in another generation, as I see it. So the National Education Program is trying to promote faith in our American way of life.
I know in the high school level, which you mentioned, you've been working with citizenship seminars. Starting back in 1956, the National Education Program and Harding College together developing a seminar for 22 students, and that has had tremendous growth, hasn't it, over the years?
It has had tremendous growth, and of course you've been a definite factor in it, because as Vice President of Harding College and as Dean of the School of American Studies, You served as chairman of the first youth forum and directed this program. You've helped carry it to other places. And the National Education Program is continuing to spend a good deal of money on these youth forums, and we've been helping conduct them and promote them till they're running now in a dozen states of the Union, reaching probably 5,000 young people each year. And these young people then follow up and really do things on their own. Very remarkable how they'll get busy to help create a better understanding when they get home. I've had letters the last few weeks from young people just explaining the things they've been doing in the past year. And it's amazing the things they're doing, the interest they're creating.
Dr. Benson, what is the influence, in your estimation, of the National Education Program today? Of course, as you indicated earlier, some people take pot shots at you, like some educators that don't really understand. And I've heard people say that the National Education Program is ultra-conservative and right-wing and this kind of thing. How do you explain this, and what do you feel is the real influence of the program?
Well, the criticism is really, I think, inspired by the same motives that inspired the criticism of missionaries in China. The communist goal was to drive out the missionaries. The best way to do it was turn the Chinese against them. The only way to do that was to deceive the people. Well, I think the communists are promoting the same tactics here, particularly since 1960. The communists in convention have been asking for an attack on the anti-communist groups. And I think they were sure at that time that they had infiltrated our means of communication enough that they could undertake to make anti-communist America unpopular and probably succeed. And they have quite well succeeded in various areas in making anti-communists unpopular in America. So I think the names were called ultra-conservative and so on are in accord with normal communist tactics. That's their way of trying to silence all the anti-communists. And they're making it work pretty well. They have silenced most of them. And that's been very fortunate for them. And I think it helped pave the way for a greater effectiveness of the communist propaganda. Now back to your other question. How does the National Education Program stand today? Well, the fact that we have never started a youth forum yet, that we weren't invited back to hold another one the next year, is, in my opinion, a pretty good indication of the esteem in which we're held. I think we're held in high esteem by the people who know us and know what we're doing, and we're probably held in low esteem by the people who hear our critics and don't know what we're doing.
This is quite understandable. People speak and complain sometimes from ignorance. Dr. Benson, I'd like to turn to your life itself, to something of your philosophy and your family and the things that you feel have been most satisfactory in your life, and maybe even some of the regrets that you have. I know all of us have them from time to time. But what about your family now? You mentioned you had two daughters born to you in China, came back to the United States. What has been the result of these young ladies and perhaps their lives?
Well, Ruth and Lois came here, of course. Harding College had a grammar school and a high school, so they were able to do all of their schoolwork after returning right here. Lois soon became very well Americanized, so well Americanized that she's always wanting something she couldn't have. You know, that's a sign of an American. We have so much, we get to thinking we can just have everything. So I was interested in helping Lois to understand that even if she didn't get everything she wanted, maybe America was still a pretty good place. On arrival in New York City, she first thought it was like heaven to be here. But when she couldn't have enough evening gown, enough evening shoes, and enough other things, and couldn't have a convertible when she was a student in college, well, then she began to wonder if things were going so well. So I sat down and talked to her one day, and I said, "Listen, honey, I'm sorry you can't have all the things you want, but just don't forget that you're in America, and that you've got access to more of the things you want than you'd have anywhere else in the world. I'm sorry we can't get those extra evening gowns you want, and more shoes, and even a convertible, but we just can't do it now." Well, Lois looked at me with those longing eyes, and she still wanted that convertible. So finally I said, "Well, honey, you can have that convertible." Then her eyes sparkled, and she said, "When, Daddy?" And she was senior then in college, had never learned the value of a dollar, didn't know how to earn a dollar. I said, honey, you can have that convertible just as soon as you earn the money to buy it. That took sparkle out of her eyes, but she began immediately thinking about how she's going to earn some money. So she went over to Ball Knob, you know. I say that's named for one of our former history professors. And got a job teaching school. Made a budget to determine just how she was going to save money for that convertible. So much had to go for boarding room. So much had to go for clothes. And the rest would be saved for that convertible. But she never made a budget. She didn't know what would be required. So things would come up that weren't in her budget. And she'd write a check on me and save for that convertible. Finally, the first school year was finished. And she'd saved pretty strenuously. But she didn't have enough to buy that convertible. But you know, in America, you don't have to ever get discouraged if you can't succeed one way. You got opportunity another because this is the land of the free. So that summer, Lois married a convertible. Now she has four children. And the oldest three are already members of the church. The younger one's only a year old. Lois's husband is working with Russell Brown Company in Little Rock. Ruth married Noma Crowder and lives in Macomb, Illinois. He is now working in construction as a builder of houses, contractor. And his oldest daughter is here in Harding College this year. They have a total of five children.
So you had two daughters and nine grandchildren. That's how many boys, right. How many girls in the group?
Four girls, five boys.
I know she had to stop for a minute and think, just like a grandparent. And you and your wife both have been blessed with good health all these years, I think.
That's right.
Been very wonderful. Dr. Benson, I remember you when you were many years younger. In fact, it was 30 years ago when I first came to Harding College, and your hair was black at that time instead of white as it is now. A lot's happened in the last 30 years. I remember making some trips with you, and as I recall, in your life, you drove fast, you walked fast, and you talked fast, and acted fast. You were not one to waste much time. You were quite a vigorous young person, and I've been so delighted this afternoon in being able to interview you and to talk with you about your life, because I think that people who hear this, even years to come, will know that even though you're in your 71st year, you still are a man of much vigor and a man of action. You know, some people tend, when they get a little older, to sort of take it easy and just sort of slip along and slide through the remaining years of life, but not so in your case. And I appreciate your great interest in people and young people and your interest in the work of the Lord and Christian education and mission endeavors and other activities, too. I know that you had many satisfactions in life, but what would you pick out as maybe some of the highlights, the things that to you were most satisfying?
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned my moving at a pretty strong pace, and I've done that. When I was a student in high school, I had a certain amount of work on a farm to do, and we farmed about 200 acres to row crops, and then my father would engage certain extra work for me to do in the fall. I remember taking a shift at night, a moonlight night with a team in the field to try to get work finished up where I could get off to school on schedule. But this has always been my philosophy. This is the world to work in, the next one to rest in. So I've continued to hit a pretty hard pace. And I think I've been able to do it because I can always relax. I can work hard and push things hard and then sit down and relax immediately, lie down and go to sleep, sit down and relax at the table. Now then, things that are means of satisfaction. Well, the greatest satisfaction, I think, comes in seeing the things you've worked for achieved and in having personal friends. I think our personal friends are the greatest asset we have in this life. And when you have friends and when you can see your goals achieved, what more could you want?
Yes. Any regrets?
Oh, of course. As I look back now, I could have taken better advantage of opportunities that were open before me if I'd known how to do it. Of course, I was doing perhaps the best I knew how to do then, but I could have done a good deal better than I did then if I'd had the experience and the know-how I've got now.
Yes. Do you think over the years that your philosophy of life has changed basically? Or has this frontier experience and the training and teaching of your parents pretty well stuck with you through life?
It has been, I think, very important. And I think the chief attitudes toward life haven't changed. And I'm persuaded that most people, by the time they're through high school, have pretty well adopted the chief attitudes toward life. Attitude toward themselves, attitude toward others, and attitude toward God. And those are the three chief major attitudes. And I don't think mine have changed a lot. And my ideas long ago that with hard work and stickability, you could achieve nearly any goal you wanted, I think still right and fundamental.
You've seen an awful lot happen in the last 70 years. I know you're not a prophet or the son of a prophet, but would you like to surmise just a little bit and sort of anticipate what you think might occur here in the United States with regard to our nation, with regard to the church, and with regard to Christian education? Those things in which you've been so deeply involved, what do you see so far as the future is concerned?
Well, let me do a little explaining before coming to a conclusion. I think that we live in God's world, that He's the great master, and I think Jesus put it very straight in the Sermon on the Mount when He said, "Seek ye first God's kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." I'm convinced that righteousness is any nation's greatest asset. In America, I think we've had an unusual measure of righteousness. People have come here to try to discover the secret of our achievement and have gone away believing that it was found in the fact that our pulpits were aflame with a message of righteousness. Today that message is cooling off. Even Christian people are more lukewarm. There's less dedication. We're tending to do what I think a number of other civilizations have done. For instance, when I was in Japan, the man who was ambassador from Japan to America at the time World War II started, who was interned over here till the war was over, talked with me. He said, "You Americans see white and black. We in Japan don't see white and black. We see gray. We see a mingling of the black and the white." In other words, it isn't a matter that some things are definitely right, other things are definitely wrong. But it's a matter that things are comparatively right and comparatively wrong. Well, I think in America we're tending in that direction. And that our real concern for God and His Word is deteriorating. Now, if that goes on, America will continue to go down. And when you look at the agitation that's going on in America today, the riots on our campuses, and the burnings of our cities, and you see how permissive our government is, how tolerant it is of such, then it would look like to me we're moving toward more serious troubles, and that America would face more and more troubles in the future. We're a powerful country. America can't likely be destroyed in a few years or a generation, but it looks like you can see which way she's moving, and it would appear to be the way Rome moved. And Rome certainly didn't fall because she'd fulfilled her mission, nor because her leadership was no longer needed. Her leadership was needed. She stood on the brink of her greatest possibilities. Yet Rome lost the sense of her mission. Permissiveness came. Character deteriorated. And finally the people of Rome were no longer willing to fight for the preservation of Rome. And her fall ushered in the Dark Ages, a period when men moved backward, not forward, and it lasted for approximately 1,000 years. It looks like to me America today is possibly following the trend that Rome did, and the trend that England has. When I was a high school youngster, England was the foremost nation of the world. She had an empire on which the sun did never set. She was mistress of the seas. Today, England is a fourth-rate power. She's moving down, and I see no sign of her moving upward again. Well, Egypt, Babylonia, Persia, Syria, Greece, Rome, each had its day on a stage of action. Each moved downward. If America doesn't move down that western slope, she'll be the first country not to do so. And if we follow the course of all the nations before us, we will move down that western slope. But we have enough educated people. We have far better communications. I don't think that's necessary. So I'd like to see us try to resell our own people on integrity and honor and on faith in God and on righteousness to the end that God's favor might rest upon us, his providence might be ours, and that we might go on enjoying world leadership, helping promote freedom, helping promote humanity on its road to a better life, and help pilot the way for multitudes to heaven.
I know, Dr. Benson, in just a few hours' time, it's difficult to include everything in one's life, especially a life that's been so full as yours and so much in service of others. But we've tried in about 2.5 hours to cover 70 years of activity. Is there anything else that you would like to leave with posterity so far as philosophy or anything else that you think should be included? Any area that we've passed over this afternoon that you might like to include?
Oh, not that I think of right now.
All right. May I say this, that I know that you've received many honors and awards at the hands of men, but I know that you're seeking that one great reward when the Lord says, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant," and this has been your chief aim in life, as evidenced in all that you've done in his name through all these years. I know, too, that the name of George S. Benson will be deeply embedded not only at Harding College, but in the lives of multitudes of people in Christian education and missionary activities and citizenship education, in fact, nationally as well as locally. And I feel so privileged this afternoon in being able to induct you, Dr. George S. Benson, into the Harding College Oral History Library and to preserve for posterity not only a portion of your life, but also your voice, which to me indicates so much of your character and vigor, and I know that people in listening to this tape, even years hence, will be able to know something more about you by reason of our spending these few hours together today. Thank you so very, very much for being with us and for telling us something about your life and your philosophy of life.
Well, thank you, Dr. Gaines, and certainly you have my best wishes for your work here and the future of Harding College, and I'm delighted with the way the institution's advancing and the way I know it'll continue to advance under your leadership.
Thank you.